work session, it's not gonna be a formal hearing. What I'd like to do is to have, John, you may as well join us at the table, this is a work session.
Do you have a nameplate for me?
What's that?
Do you have a nameplate for me?
We can get you one.
Moderator, the chairman is here now, we should be getting started.
John, why don't you come on up, is there a representative from, Michelle, would you like to join us? And Ann, if you'd like, Av, if you'd like, certainly welcome to join us. Janice, did you want to say anything?
I would rather look at your face.
Okay.
Ah, what we can learn.
Is Al is here?
I saw him in the hall.
Gene, why don't you join us at the table here and,
Ever.
Is Al Hastings up here?
Yes, he is.
Al, why don't you join us at the table, we'll pull up the chair there.
Thanks for the pizza.
Yeah, I've got a few members here. Oh, so it looks like there's more than three here.
Why don't you take that seat there? Is there anyone here from Alyeska? Nobody here from Alyeska? Too bad. You know anybody's coming from Alyeska?
I saw Mike Williams asking if he's coming, but I don't think he is.
Too bad, we had a good question for him.
I saw him walking down the street, it looked like he was going to dinner.
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and get started. We're just starting up the work session here on House Bill 196, and this is the subcommittee of the House Resources. We have committee members, Representative Carney, Representative Lehman, and Chairman Davidson. At the table, we have Ricky Ott, John Tillinghast, Al Hastings, Gene Burden, Michelle Brown, and
Grothy,
and Av Gross. So first, I'd like to call on Mike Ford, and Mike Ford is the drafter of the legislation. And if you would, Mike, let's go through line by line.
Okay.
And people jump in where there are problems with the legislation, where there is disagreement, where it, where whatever is bothering anybody, let's go line by line and see if we can't work into a bill that we can't come up with some kind of solution. It's a bill that I think has far-reaching ramifications, and we have to think not only in terms of Alyeska or even in terms of Tesoro or Conoco, but also the people in Kodiak, the people in Southeast. We have, I think, a major piece of work to do to come up with something that we can all live with and not send the cost of fuel to the consumer out the ceiling. So with that, Mike, I'd just like for you to
jump
go
in
ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think what I'd like to do is, if it's not too boring for the committee, is maybe start with a little bit of the bigger picture and see if I can lead into this bill, just to make sure we're all kind of together on the big issues here. I think that it would maybe be easier to understand some of the complexities contained in House Bill 196 if I did that, and I'll try to be as quick and as brief as I can. The essence of House Bill 196 is to shift liability. And liability typically is something that is determined by the courts. Now, the legislature occasionally will pass a law which will adjust the formula by which we determine who is liable for what. Until 1972, the question of liability for hazardous substances, for spills and things of that nature, was simply a matter of determining who was negligent for the act. In 1972, the legislature changed that by passing a strict liability law, and that is 4603.822. As I mentioned, that was first passed in 1972. It established strict liability for hazardous spills. That was the law pretty much until 1989, when it was rewritten by the legislature, and I'm not sure that the legislature improved it, but it now sets out a provision for strict liability for release of hazardous substances, makes a number of exceptions, a number of provisions for determining when someone is or is not liable. Also in 1989, we passed a provision of law regarding the response action contractor, and providing that that person basically is not going to be strictly liable, but would be liable for negligence or some greater type of misconduct. And that brings us to the present bill, which is actually an effort to carve out a special niche for oil spills. So we've taken the law on hazardous substance response action contractors, which applies to all types of contractors that, deal with that, not just oil spills. And we're carving out an exception which would provide basically a limitation of liability for the negligence of those kinds of contractors. And sort of with that beginning, I can jump into House Bill 196 if there aren't any questions.
Mike, would you please go over the last two sentences again, please, that you just gave?
We basically have a system of liability in our law. If you are negligent for something, the court would award damages to someone for your negligence. Starting out, as I said, in 1972, we decided, well, we're going to hold some people strictly liable. It doesn't matter if they're negligent or not. You're going to be strictly liable for the damage you cause. And in this particular case, the damages are hazardous substance releases. Is that what you're referring to, the
yes.
distinction there?
Yeah.
That's a fundamental issue. The legislature decided that these people, for the, I guess, the reasons of public concern, are going to be liable whether they are negligent or not. Whether they act as a reasonable person should or not, they're going to be liable for the damages they cause. That's a policy issue decided by the legislature and embodied in 4603.822. So if we start from that position that we're going to hold some people strictly liable, then I think the question raised by the response action contractor is, are they going to operate under the same rules? And the legislature decided no. In 4603.823, the legislature said, well, we're only going to hold these people liable if they're negligent. In other words, there's no strict liability for those people, assuming they meet the qualifications in the law. Now, that is, I assume, in an effort to provide a quick response to get those people out to clean up. That's the concept.
Mike, I'll let it be your call. We're going to have lots of questions. Would you prefer to go through the thing and then have questions, or if we keep it to a reasonable number of questions, would it be okay to break in and ask your question?
Either way is fine with me.
Okay.
Whatever's.
We'll just go ahead then. Go ahead, Representative Finkelstein.
Thank you, Chairman. Just briefly, what are the requirements that make you eligible for? You just mentioned there's some requirements that make you eligible for not being under the strict liability. So there's some requirements you've got to meet.
Is the requirements contained in 4603.823. If you and they're very complex, but a person who is response action contractor, first of all, we have a definition for that person. They respond, they respond in a way that's not contrary to a response plan. That's an exception to the rule. They're not going to be civilly liable except for the negligence or greater type of misconduct. And that's in contrast to the strict liability standard. And I think that's important to understand how that works. If we go back far enough, as I said, the issue is, were you negligent? Did you fail to act as a reasonable person would in those circumstances? That's sort of the essence of negligence. If we go to the strict liability, then it's no longer were you reasonable or not. It's simply, did you do it? And to qualify for the 823 standard, again, you have to fall within the application of the law. And
which is generally some sort of criteria to determine who's response action contractor.
That's one threshold question. Are you a response action contractor? There are also a number of exceptions contained in the law, and that's one of the reasons that it is complex. But assuming you meet the requirements of 823, then you're no longer strictly liable. You're simply liable for negligence or a greater form of misconduct if you intentionally did it, or if you're grossly negligent, which are just greater forms.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Kern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to go back a little bit and try to understand some of the changes that happened in 72. And
okay.
I guess if I understand correctly, the person who owned the oil at that time was just automatically responsible if the oil was filled. Is that the situation when you say that there?
In 1972, and I don't have that version with me, but I believe that's essentially correct. If you spilled oil, or a hazardous substance, which oil is, then you're liable.
If it spills, then because you own it, you're liable.
And there are some exceptions, but assuming the exceptions don't apply, act of God, war, that kind of thing.
And then if I could continue, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue.
Then in 1989, there were new regulations and laws set up, and what changes were made?
Well, they're very difficult to summarize simply, but if you were to look at 4603.822, they basically attempted to rewrite that whole section, and I was not involved in that rewrite, so it's difficult for me to understand what happened here, but it looks like there were a number of particular interests that were attempted to be accommodated here. And it resulted in the basic framework of the law being altered. We still have the strict liability, but we have a number of exceptions now. So it was a major rewrite of the section. And I am not sure that it was done I think it was very difficult to understand what they did. But it provides strict liability, and it provides it in a way that's very difficult to understand in application, but I think the thrust of it is to provide for a number of different exceptions here in certain instances, and without actually going through them, it's even hard to describe them. But there are exceptions, and if you looked at the law in A, there are a number of conditions in which you have to meet in order to be liable. There's some defenses set out in a subsection B. There's an exception in another subsection. It made this a very complex division. And I can only assume that there were a number of interests that they were trying to meet in doing that. Does that get
Thank you, Chairman.
it is difficult to understand.
Well, I'm trying to figure out where we started from, so I'll know what we're trying to head and why.
Well, let me say this. We started out by saying a group of people are going to be strictly liable. Those people are going to be strictly liable with some very narrow exceptions to that liability. I think after the Exxon Valdez, there was a thought that we needed to rewrite this in order to to make it more comprehensive, maybe to get to some people we weren't getting to before. But I really can't even say that. All I know is that the changes made in 1989, I think, greatly make this much more difficult to interpret. And it's important, I think, now, because if we're going to go back in and make some exceptions to this area, then you have to consider the effects of those changes in this section. And I can give you one clear example of that. If what I'm saying is not clear, I'll attempt to make it clear in this way. What House Bill 196 would do is create an exception for oil spill response action contractors. And it attempts to shift the liability to the spiller. But that assumes, of course, the spiller is going to be liable under the provisions of law as they exist now. So when you make a change to the liability of the contractor, the oil spill contractor, you have to consider the liability of the spiller. And the liability of the spiller is contained in 822, which was rewritten in 1989, and I think is, again, difficult to understand. So it's all connected.
And if we pass 196 as it's presently written,
yes,
can you assure me that the right people will still be responsible?
Well, all I can do is tell you that, well, no, I don't think I can answer that question, because I'm not sure who the right people are.
Well, I meant the original concept was the people who own the oil would be responsible for the spill. Is that mm-hmm. going to be the case mm-hmm. with this change?
That's a question that's impossible to answer. I can tell you that is the purpose of this bill is to do that. But giving you an answer in the absence of a specific situation, I can't answer that question. You're asking me, for example, if the right person is going to be liable. I think that was the intent of amending 822 in 1989. I'm not sure it was reached. And I think that is perhaps the most important question that you should try and figure out in this committee, is that the people you intend to be liable are in fact the ones you target.
So who's going to tell us that?
I can tell you, and given the certain set of facts, who would be liable. I can do that.
But you can't always bring up all the facts involved, no. So we have to make certain that it's covered under any circumstances.
Correct.
So that's what we need to hear from someone. Right. A method for that to be accomplished. Mr. Chairman, mm-hmm. you have some questions.
Representative Lehman, I think you had a comment.
Are we tuned in to somebody?
Yes, we are tuned in to Homer and Valdez.
I wouldn't want them to miss this. Mike, and just stating through the history, I'm just trying to remember what we did in 1989. I know a number of things were done in April of that year. Are you talking about House Bill 68? And that was the major, I mean, there was a vehicle for the major changes in that section, right? If you remember that.
I actually didn't work in that area. All I know is
shaking your hands.
Okay. And if I remember the history, that bill was on the way, it came out of the administration, and it was sort of kicked into high gear right after this bill. But although I think there was some work done on it. Is that correct? Remember, Janice?
It was worked on, I think, in every committee that had it. I followed it when I was working for the legislature, and the one that sticks in my mind most is Senate Judiciary. They had it for a long time, worked on it extensively. Added a lot of the language that's in there.
Okay. Well, you had it after we had it.
That's correct.
The House bill. And I think we had it after this bill, if I remember correctly.
Uh-huh.
Well, you can check that.
It was prior.
Finished? Yeah. Rick, you had a comment?
Yeah, just a real quick question. In 1972, everybody was liable, right? And when we had strict liability, that means that the response action contract, I think this is a question that Representative Carney was asking, and not everybody was liable. Everybody was strictly liable. Is that correct? So if response action contractors were liable, the oil industry, potential spiller was liable. Everybody had the same, it was strict liability. That was it.
There was no consideration given to someone who responded to this bill. They didn't get any special consideration.
So in 89, it was, when you say carved out response action contractors, that Representative Carney, I think that's what...
Right. Yeah, that's what I wanted to make.
Okay. Yeah. I thought that was what...
Special provision was made in 1989.
Yeah.
John, you had a comment.
I think it would help to have the 72 language around, but I think the problem was that when the strict liability law was passed in 72, it didn't mention cleanup contractors at all. The responsible party and maybe the owner of the person who spilled and maybe the owner of the oil was liable. But, and Michelle can help here, when did we change 822 to adopt the federal Superfund language for liability? Was that the 89 changes or were those the 79 changes?
I think it was the 89 changes.
Well, those changes completely revoked the section by using federal hazardous waste law as the language for liability rather than what Alaska passed in 72. And in the hazardous waste field, there are different kinds of cleanup contractors. They're the people who put hazardous waste in drums and go bury it in the desert. And people wanted those people to be covered under the strict liability section. The trouble is, Alaska also chose to define hazardous waste to include oil, which the federal law doesn't. And so as a result, for the first time, and I think inadvertently, Alaska brought its oil spill cleanup contractors into the strict liability loop. That was not done originally in 72, and I don't think it was a conscious choice in 89. And
go ahead, John.
I would say, incidentally, it was because of that almost inadvertent roping of response action contractors into the strict liability regime that you've got the exception now under both federal hazardous waste law and federal oil spill law. People caught it and said, oh my God.
Additional comments? Anybody before we go on here?
Maybe I could just, it might be a long evening at this rate, but I always have found it amazing that oil is not considered a hazardous waste until it's spilled, and then it's treated as a hazardous waste. So I think Alaska perhaps made the right choice, and it wasn't inadvertent at all.
Why don't you continue, Mike, and then...
Okay.
Just before you go, my intent is we got started 15 minutes late, so we'll go until 8:15. If we're at a crucial point, we can go to 8:30, but not beyond 8:30.
Okay. Okay, well, with that preliminary, I think I will start with discussing House Bill 196, the Oil and Gas Committee Substitute. Section 1 is a findings and purpose section. This was added, I think, basically my recommendation to do basically one thing, and that is to try and indicate to persons interested in the future, and I'm sure there will be many of them, why the legislature is doing this. I mentioned one equal protection issue which may arise, and I think in dealing with that particular issue, it is helpful to know the reason that the legislature is doing this. And so that's the findings and purpose section. I don't know if anyone has any questions on that.
Any questions on the findings and purpose? Any comments? Ms. Chevron.
Now I was going to ask where these findings came from. I understand a statement of purpose, but these findings seem to be fairly lengthy, showing that there was a deterrent and all kinds of other things that I don't see a record for, at least in this state, if not anywhere in the world. Because, you know, when you're talking about the historical context, the use of response action contractors has really changed. It's, you know, there is that inadvertent quality you mentioned, John, but there's also the use of them in implementing contingency plans has certainly changed over the years. And as we became far more aggressive in what we required in contingency plans, the need for response action contractors heightened because no one person could have enough equipment. And I just am troubled by these findings because I don't see any support for them. And if we can't relate them to where to what the real problem is, we may end up not drafting to address the problem because we're mischaracterizing the problem.
I believe the findings were basically prepared by John Tillinghast. So, John, would you like to comment on that?
Sure, yeah, I try to be a good lawyer and make sure that the record has adequate authority for all of the findings. For example, on the deterrent issue, there's evidence into the record as to the deterrent effect that Alaska's existing laws have had on MSRC's eagerness to come into the state, on the troubles that CISPRI has had in recruiting members to its organization, and in fact, on Alyeska's reluctance to provide cleanup services under reasonable terms and conditions. There were additional findings, well, let's see, we're looking on 196, oil and gas, so that comment doesn't apply. If there are other ones that cause you specific concern as to whether there's anything in the record, maybe we ought to go through those rather than trying to give a lecture on all of them. I tried to highlight the one that you mentioned, but I'm sure I've done a lousy job, but I've tried to make sure that the record is in fact adequate and we can define it.
Well, I think rather than bring everyone in, unless anyone else wants to do that, you and I can do that later and report back or something.
But is there anyone on the committee who wishes to pursue this item?
I'd rather not, Mr. Chairman.
And ultimately, of course, if I could, Mr. Chairman, It doesn't matter whether I think the record's adequate or not. It's the legislature that enacts this law, and the legislature won't enact it with these findings unless they believe that the record supports those conclusions. These ultimately are your words, not mine.
Mm-hmm. So if there are additional findings, then that's something that we should be thinking about as well, right?
Right.
Well, why don't you continue, Mike? And
thank you. Okay, if we're done with findings and purpose, we'll move to section two, which starts on page two, line 30. This is an amendment of existing law, and it's the infamous 822 section I referred to earlier. What we are attempting to do here is two things. One, to make this section a little easier to read by eliminating some language on page three. We're deleting some existing language. That language is reinserted in section three as a definition of damages. That's the first thing we're trying to do, is to make section 822A read a little better, just do a little bit of cleanup there. And then in section three, we reinsert the damage language with one addition, and that is additional language contained on page 3, starts on line 30 with and damage, and it goes through page 4, line 1. That provision is intended to provide that the spiller would in fact be held liable for damages caused by a response action contractor, for which the response action contractor is not liable. In other words, if we have if we give some immunity to the oil spill response action contractor, they are found to be not liable, then the concept is to leave the spiller on the hook. And that basically is contained in section three.
Any questions or comments on section two or three? No questions. Please continue.
Okay, section four, we are again amending some existing law here. The present law on oil spill response action contractors, subsection A is contained in section four. All we're doing here is we're carving out the exception. So we're providing that the substance of 4603.823A will not apply to a response action contractor who spills oil or who responds to an oil spill. So that's the only purpose of section 4, is to make sure that they do not fall under the provisions of section 823.
Ricky,
Well, I just have a comment on that, and that is, if the next spill we have is a hazardous waste spill, rather than an oil spill, are we going to rewrite this whole law again? I mean, that was the impetus behind this, was the Exxon Valdez spill, and I think this is pretty crazy to be chipping away at our laws. So I guess that's all I want to say.
Any other comments or questions? Please continue, Mike.
Okay, it brings us to Section 5, which is the part of the bill. Here we have created a new law which would impose liability on oil spill response action contractors, and it imposes the liability in a manner differently than in our existing law. The person who is an oil spill response action contractor is not going to be held liable for negligence or held strictly liable, for that matter. The provisions in A1 and 2 set out the essence of the liability that we're creating here. Perhaps we better go through that fairly slowly, since I said this is the heart of the bill. We have used similar language that exists in 823. You may notice there is a strong similarity between subsection A and 825 and subsection A and 823. That was deliberate to try and pattern the language on existing law. We essentially provide here that the oil spill response action contractor is not civilly liable unless you can show by a preponderance of the evidence certain things, and that is in paragraphs 1 and 2. Paragraph 1 provides that there is liability if they have not carried out their response action. In other words, there's some other kind of liability other than attached to their going out there to clean up the spill. That's paragraph 1. Paragraph 2 provides there is liability if they act with gross negligence or intentional misconduct. So we have carved out again, we have eliminated negligence and strict liability.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Finkelstein, go ahead.
Could you state number 1 again?
Yeah,
I understand it.
It's an awkward way to say it, but what it comes down to is if there is liability that would exist aside from your coming out to clean up the oil, if you can show that if the contractor hadn't gone out there to clean up, that he would have been liable, then he's going to be liable. And I can't think of an example of that, but maybe John can.
Yeah, I guess that's what I was going to get at. It seems like they're saying here, if you're the spiller, you're not liable. You own oil. You're not.
Use your mic, please.
You're not exempt just because you happen to go out and clean it up. It's still, if you had the original liability, it applies to you. You don't get the exemption.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Adair.
On page 3, Representative
Finkelstein. Would you please use the mic? We have people in home. We have people in Fulmer who can't hear us.
Just to make it easier, on page 3 where 822 is laid out, you can see the other reasons why someone would be liable. They were the owner of the hazardous substance, they were the owner of the operator of the vessel facility, they were the person with the time of disposal owned or operated the facility. So those would be some of the people that would be liable, even if they were also the response action contractor.
John Tillingham.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it is, Representative Finkelstein is right that it's awkward wording, and it's been suggested to us by a number of people that since 822 is the statute who tells you who is liable, that what you ought to say is the response action contractor would have been liable for the release or threatened release under AS 4603 822, even if the contractor had not carried out a response action. And that's much more direct. I don't know at what point you want to take a board of suggestions that you just got your first one.
Well, I think it's a good question. I think we'll have staff make note of these proposed changes, and then we'll come back
on our next work session with these proposed changes in writing and fit it in where we've discussed it and see how that looks. Go ahead, Mike.
Okay.
Were there any other questions or comments? Please continue.
Okay, so that's basically subsection A. In subsection B, we talk about when A doesn't apply. And there are two instances where the provisions of A will not apply. And these are, at least one of them is similar to existing law, and maybe the second one is too, although I can't recall at present. But if you have an action for personal injury or death, then we won't apply this limitation. And number two is if it is an act or omission contrary to something in a response action contract or a representation of the response action contractor. I think this is language, again, that John Tillinghast came up with, which is intended to cover a specific instance where someone claims to have an ability that they don't really have.
So that would be, excuse me, so if the contractor, the spill response contractor, has a C plan and makes representations within that plan that he will do such and such, and he does not in fact do such and such in this time of emergency, then this B2 applies?
John Tillinghast here, Mr. Chairman. That's correct, but only if the response action contractor's failure or shortcoming was caused by his gross negligence. If it was caused by his simple negligence, he would still be protected under this version of the bill.
Could you expand on that? Why one and not the other? Because earlier we've already exempted.
Okay. Yeah, subsection A says essentially you're not liable unless you're grossly negligent.
Okay.
B then goes on to say, however, that doesn't govern in this situation. The situation being a deviation from this plan. The theory behind the language is that if you take away somebody's immunity because of a simply negligent violation of a plan, you have gone back to a simple negligence standard when the intent of the bill is to shield the contractor from gross negligence. But that's the reason that you have to, if that's the committee's policy preference, is to shield him from gross negligence, even in this situation, you would need to say that in B2, given the fact that B as a whole is an exception to A. Was that the chairman's question? Or?
Well, I would like to know, maybe we can prepare language as you suggest, and then if we can take a look at that and see what that accomplishes, then I would know what my question was. Hear me? You follow me?
No.
Okay. I can see we have a lot of work to do on this bill. Well, what I'd like to understand is if the response contractor has not done something that he has represented he will do in a situation of responding to a spill, where does that leave us with two? As you have indicated, well, I didn't understand how you tied B2 back to A2.
It's very confusing.
A2 says you're not liable for anything you do during cleanup unless you're grossly negligent.
Okay.
B as a whole creates an exception to that.
Let me, could I try?
Yeah, I'm not getting anywhere yet.
Can I try?
Go ahead.
Okay. There are two kinds of people who respond to a spill. Sometimes you have a spill, you don't know who spilled it, right? Mm-hmm. So it may be out there. So people rush out on a volunteer basis, for instance, and they don't have a spill contingency plan because, I mean, you may have a national one, but you don't have a specific one for this spill because you don't even know who spilled it, right? So people rush out to do the work and one thing or another, and they're negligent, okay? And A immunizes them if they're negligent, as long as they're not gross negligent, right? Now, what the second B part of the bill that John is describing is that people who actually agree to follow spill contingency plans, right, who actually have a plan for a specific spill, okay, and who don't for one reason or another, this bill would also immunize them unless they're grossly negligent, okay? So they cannot follow the plan and still be held not liable under this bill as written now, as long as they're only simply negligent as opposed to grossly negligent. You see the two categories, one who are following a written plan and people who are not following a written plan, but they're both under this bill held to the same standard of liability. Does that clear it up at all?
A little bit. So if we were to say, what happens if the bill, it sounds like we're getting into something where we want to exempt, say, volunteers or nonprofit kinds of organizations. Is that?
Well, nonprofits and volunteers, of course, can be two different categories. It's really difficult to figure out in the context of this bill, and we've struggled with it, who are profits and who are nonprofits, because, you know, you get a nonprofit organization, they go hire VECO to clean it up. You know, so I mean, like, you know, who's the profit and who's the nonprofit? Mm-hmm. You can have a cooperative group that hires a group of fishermen and pays them, you know, to do it. So really hard to separate it out on the basis of profit or nonprofit. I tried, to be frank with you, but I couldn't get there. But the real different category, as I see it, are people who respond to clean up spills where there is no plan that they've agreed to follow and they just get out there and try and do their best to clean it up. That's category A. And category B are people who have actually agreed to follow a specific spill plan for this particular kind of spill.
And that doesn't necessarily mean a professional responder.
Could be a cooperative.
Yeah.
Could be anybody.
Did we have another question over here? David, did you have any?
Well, yeah, it seems to me that second category, the category we're talking about in B, someone who's subject to a plan who's grossly negligent, or who isn't grossly negligent, they're already, it seems to me that group is already covered in A2 because they are going to be acting if they act without gross negligence, they've already been accepted here because they fit into A2. They fit into A already.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think that John drafted a large part of this, so I should let him speak for himself, but I think he was concerned that even though it was a general category that seemed to cover everybody, that when you dealt with people who had specifically filed a written plan, that people might view it differently. So he wrote a specific section in to cover that. But he wrote it, so he should tell you.
Yeah, and
go
I
ahead,
think,
John, tell me
I think, thanks, Mr. Chairman, and that may be one of the reasons I wasn't getting very far on the prior question. Representative Finkelstein is absolutely right that here's how this thing got drafted. We said you're not liable unless you're grossly negligent. And somebody else would say, yeah, but you've got to follow your contingency plan if in fact you wrote one. And we said, fine, we'll put that in B2, but it's still important that you not be liable until you're grossly negligent because we don't want to get rid of the standard. And so as a result, B2 does, with some subtle differences that we probably don't need to get into, to restate A2.
Deborah Vogt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just was actually going to say, I think that the confusion over this section is the reason that it looks like it doesn't do anything is that it doesn't do anything. I mean, the standard that's set is gross negligence, and then it says if you're under a contingency plan, then the standard's gross negligence. And so it really, I think that's confusing is because it doesn't do anything.
So what do we want it to do?
Are you asking me?
Well, could I?
Please go ahead, Ed.
I just want to point out that at this point, you know, the parties start to diverge a little bit, and there are some differences of opinion over the bill. I think, for instance, that Tesoro comes forward, you know, with a specific problem having to do with Alyeska and problems shipping oil out of the terminal in Valdez, and feels that they need additional protections for a spill action a response bill contractor, in order that the contractor will continue to allow them to do business with them, in a nutshell. I think that the group that I represent, which is RCAC, feels that limited immunity may make sense in situations where volunteer organizations and one thing are going out, but that when people file spill response plans and specifically say that they're going to do the following things in an emergency, in essence anticipating an emergency, and saying when we have an emergency, this is what we will do, that gross negligence is not a healthy standard to apply to commitments that people make in writing and get formally approved by the state. And that in those instances, whereas people should be held to, you know, nobody's perfect, and certainly some deviation from a plan that they've already agreed on in the past is reasonable, that anything beyond a substantial deviation from the plan should expose them to their own negligence. And we differ from Tesoro and Conoco on this viewpoint.
Ann Rothy?
Yeah, I just want to follow up on what Av says and stress that
you have
that
to push this down.
Turn the switch, then you'll be.
Thanks. That is something that's real important to the members of RCAC, that we craft this bill such that the standard of care for those people who have filed spill contingency plans that are approved by the state or federal government, condition of the limit, then we create an incentive where those plans become documents that are maintained. Drills occur when they should occur, equipment is kept in good condition, and training of the actual personnel who are doing the responding occurs. And that's the crux of our concern in that particular section of the bill.
Spoken like a true Citizens Oversight Council member, thank you. I think I'll be with you in just a minute, Michelle. I was just going to say that we're having one of the problems of things we have here is the problem we're having with Rent-A-Plan, and it seems that vendor that has the plan to rent is making it. I guess we can examine that later. Michelle Brown.
Well, you said what I was going to say, so I'll put that off
until
later.
Professionally, you're probably better to enunciate it tonight, so please go ahead.
I thought Rent-A-Plan was pretty good. We have here a bill that really has two motivations. One is that there may be some problem in informing co-ops and enhancing response action contractors that we may need to address through these kind of immunity provisions. The other is the particular bind that's already been alluded to that Tesoro finds itself in. And in order to debate the public policy aspects of which classes of response action contractors we believe should be immunized for which situations, we need to have some time to address that and lay those out, chart them out. There are now probably four or five different groups of response action contractors in many different scenarios. But we can't do that while we've got sort of the tail wagging the dog, because there's this deadline creeping up on Tesoro. And so the attempts have been made to draft all contingencies in some vague language that everyone is struggling with, because we haven't answered the $64,000 questions of what classes of response action contractors are there and which situations do we believe they should be immunized in, because it will in fact enhance the state's ability to respond to spills.
Does anyone have any further comment on Ms. Brown's comment? Anyone want to pursue that area a little more?
Well, I just know I agree. It's really hard for those of us who, you know, weren't even on this committee last year and weren't able, or in 89, and weren't able to see what went on there, not only do I not have a sense of what we envisioned with some of these conservation contracts, I actually don't know, in fact, what all the categories are myself. So.
I mean, they range from a group that comes up to wash birds to a response action contractor that actually sits down, drafts a plan, and then offers it to people who are using its services as the one who will implement it on behalf of those people using its services. So you really have radically different perspectives here, and you're going to want to apply different standards of care depending on that class, probably. And I think it's fairly dangerous to lump it generically because we have this time constraint that's our arbitrarily imposed for reasons that none of us created.
John Tillinghast?
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Folks up until now haven't pursued the issue, I think, of trying to pick out which contractors you want to protect. As Av said, it's very hard to do because, for example, you find a major corporation that you don't think as a matter of equity ought to be protected, but you say nonprofits will be protected, they'll just form a nonprofit subsidiary to handle their cleanup. And the other thing is, I don't know how you draw the line. Your heart may go out most to the fishermen group, to the bird rescue center, but on the other hand, it's the big capital intensive profit making things that you may want to encourage the most, because they're the ones that will have the hard capital assets that you're going to need deployed quickly when there's a spill. And they're also the ones who need immunity the greatest, because they're the most attractive. They really do have the deep pocket. Let me say that in the many other states that have either passed this law or considered, I'm not aware of a single case where states have attempted to draw a distinction between fishermen and the oil industry, or between profits and nonprofits.
Ricky Ott?
I'd just like to add that the fishermen, at least in Prince William Sound through Cordova District Fishermen United, have already immunized themselves in their contract with Alyeska. The fishermen, as you may know, our CDFU is running a list of folks that are going to be on call and would respond to another oil spill, and I think that this is similarly is being set up in other communities, this type of fisherman contractor. And it's possible, I mean, it has been done, to immunize the fishermen directly in the contract, and I don't see why that's not also not possible for these bird rescue centers. I mean, can't they have a big contract that would immunize them? I mean, I don't know, but I'm just saying this is another angle to approach this, right, in the contract.
Maybe you could expand on how the CFU immunized itself, or the fishermen, in their relationship with Alyeska.
I can't, but I could make a phone call and get the contract over here or whatever.
Representative Lehman?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to know, in a practical sense, what is the difference to the public by an immunization by contract or an immunization by statute? A practical application, is there one?
Some people can't get the immunity. Some people, like Tesoro, for instance, is not in a position to bargain. I mean, they're not in a position to come up with the conditions that will protect them, or to get Alyeska to, you know, participate. I mean, an immunity granted by statute applies to everybody. An immunity granted by contract is only those people who are fortunate enough to negotiate the contract.
Well, plus... Well, I'm sorry.
I understand that, but I mean, if I can interpret the the rest of your statement, you know, the concern about that people may have about going after a party who is responsible, and you're not sure, well, who do we go after? We go after the response action contractor or the spiller, and we have to sort out who's responsible there. But if you have it granted by contract, you have the same challenge, unless. Because then you've got to fight over the contract. instead of a fight over the interpretation of the statute.
Oh, yeah, there's a big difference. If two parties contract one to be immune from the other from their negligence, that doesn't impact third parties. I mean, third parties can come along and sue anybody, right? And then if they're successful against somebody who's got a contract for immunity with another person, then the other person has to compensate the person they promised to keep immune, you know, against the judgment that was rendered against them. If a law comes along and says, you're immune, you can't sue them. You understand what I'm saying? All right, I mean, it's like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
John Tilling, yes.
Well, I mean, Ab stole my thunder again. I mean, that's a contract cannot immunize anybody. A contract can merely promise that if somebody else sues you, I will pay your costs, subject to whatever conditions are in the contract. I will say that a number of states have looked at an indemnification approach, which is what Ricky's talking about, and they've actually used it in the hazardous waste context. They've looked at it in terms of oil spills and said, no, it won't work. And the reason it doesn't is you can't go out and enter into a contract ahead of time with everybody you might possibly use, and now, boom, at midnight, there's a spill, and you need Harry's fishing boat, or you need clean seas, or you need somebody, and you call them up at midnight and said, get out there, and they say, my lawyer will be right over to negotiate the indemnification clause. It doesn't work. In the hazardous waste cleanup, you normally have a lot of time. Michelle and I have negotiated one, and you know, lawyers get rich talking about those things because it's normally time to. Right. He didn't get rich. I didn't either. lawyers can keep their lights on negotiating with these things. So you have the luxury of time to talk about indemnity clauses. You really don't in the oil spill context.
Representative Finkelstein?
I just had a question following up with Michelle. When we're talking about who it makes sense to immunize, what in your opinion? Can you think of classes or groups of contractors where it doesn't make sense to, any criteria we can use where it doesn't make sense to immunize?
We've been grappling with that actually for days. And I think the one category that comes to mind is if there's a response action contractor that is a professional organization that is geared up to essentially launch a business of responding on behalf of contingency plan holders or vessel operators, they draft the plan and they implement it on behalf of that holder, they should at least be accountable to adhere to that plan. Whether there should be some immunity from consequential damages downstream may be a different question, but they, at least you want to hold them accountable to adhering to that plan because they created it. And that's the basis on which the state approved the contingency plan, was that there was this group who knew how to implement it because they developed it, they've trained under it, they've drilled, they've been inspected. And that's the group that you would want to hold to the highest standard of care.
So, Mr. Chairman, just to follow it up, in that case there, if they follow the plan, do you think it's appropriate that only gross negligence apply to them? That we're saying here. If they follow the plan, if they don't follow the plan, then they're subject to simple negligence.
Right, that's correct. That's right.
And it seems to me that some of this language, you know, although it doesn't get to it, it involves a lot of the same words and a lot of the same theories. You're just not applying
no.
it that way.
No.
Good. I mean, I'm not saying this section, but just some of the, we're bringing up some of the same concepts here with the application of the plan. It seems to me that. I mean, I guess I'd be interested, not necessarily now, but today or later, some discussion on if we use that criteria, that basically everybody, it sounds to me like you're saying everybody would be judged, everyone who's one of these contractors is judged under a standard of gross negligence, except where they are subject to a contingency plan and where they fail to follow the contingency plan.
Yeah, roughly that's
some, at some point, Mr. Chairman, I'd be interested in, you know, response from others on that same topic. It may not be.
How about right now?
Different.
Anybody have, after Chairman,
if you notice, Representative Finkelstein, the basic distinction between the parties here is, I think, that the bill that Tesoro presented initially talks about, lumps everybody together, including people who agree to prepare and agree to use spill contingency plans, and says gross negligence is the standard, okay? And that means if you have a plan and you don't get held liable for simple negligence unless you're grossly negligent in deviating from the plan, right? I mean, your immunity disappears if you're grossly negligent. And the other parties here feel that a more close compliance with a spill plan is required to get you any immunity at all. You know, that if you promise to carry out a spill plan, that you don't get held to a standard of gross negligence, you get held to a different standard. Right? And that's the basic, I think, one of the major distinctions between the parties.
Yeah, let me ask this question. Let's say we have this bill in place, and we take this bill back to March 24th, 1989. Mm-hmm. Where do we stand? What is the status of the Alyeska response? Are they grossly negligent? Or how does this bill treat Alyeska if this were in effect at that time? Regards this specific spill that birthed this whole situation.
I don't think I could beat Michelle with a microphone if I tried.
That is the $64,000 question. Was what happens? The reason that's a particularly interesting question is because the issue of whether Alyeska held the contingency plan at the time of the spill for that vessel is the issue that, well, may now never be litigated, but was certainly a key issue. Historically, what happened was the state perceived that Alyeska would respond on behalf of all tankers in the TAPS trade. I won't even go into where it came, but anyway, that's what the state believed. And Alyeska, after the spill, turned over the reins to Exxon and said, it's not our problem. The state sent them a demand saying you are not to leave the field. That has, of course, become the major issue in litigation. Right after that, Alyeska said they were only the response action contractor for the spiller. The state DEC took the position, well, if that's true, we thought you were holding the contingency plans for all these tankers. The tankers, therefore, have no contingency plans and cannot come to your terminal and load oil. Alyeska then said, well, we didn't really quite mean that. We will sign a compliance order that says we will respond for them. And during the period that they were under that compliance order, the whole new system of contingency plans has been put in place where each tanker or each tanker operator now has their own contingency plan. Alyeska is no longer the contingency plan holder. And so they don't have liability for failing to implement that plan the way things stand now. The only thing that they really have that holds them there is their contractual promise and their fear of liability. You take away their fear of liability, we are back to the situation where, trust us, we will respond. But there is nothing that holds them into the field.
Additional comments, John Tillingham.
Yeah, I think that it's a real important point that Michelle made, because I think that, and I'm going to characterize this disagreement, well, this issue and the scope of the disagreement between some folks at the table and other folks at the table, and of course there's lots of folks, as many folks at the table as there are people in the state of Alaska, as whether a person ought to be held liable if he departs from a contingency plan that he wrote or agreed to comply with and was just simply negligent in doing so. That's the issue. There's another issue, but that's this issue. And it's important to realize that if the answer is yes, they should be liable, then that is an expansion of existing liability on the Alyeskas of the world. Because under state law, the people who get dinged now for not doing what's in the contingency plan is the holder of that plan, which is the shipper, Exxon, in the case of the Exxon Valdez, and not Alyeska. Now, Alyeska may be in a world of trouble with Exxon as a matter of contract, but Alyeska is not in a world of trouble with the state. With what RACAC is suggesting, Alyeska will now be in a world of trouble with the state. But their argument, and it's one that you need to consider, is that since we are expanding generally the liability of these people, it's only fair at the same time that we increase their accountability for their cleanup plan. But again, the point they're making is that they do want to expand existing liability on the cleanup contractor for the contingency plan document itself.
Well, I'm getting a little confused. In the case of Alyeska right now, as things stand under existing law, are they subject to the contingency plan? It sounds to me like they've let the shippers do it, and they aren't particularly subject to it.
But they agreed to carry out the shipper's contingency plan.
But now, if we were to try, you know, if we were to base this on the idea that it's gross negligence unless, you know, you're subject to a contingency plan, then it's simple negligence in following that plan. Okay.
That's not my concept, but go ahead.
Well, I'm just trying to understand the implications of that. They wouldn't fall under that, correct?
Yes, they
wouldn't fall under the simple negligence. They'd fall under the gross negligence because they wouldn't be subject to a contingency plan.
They are. Alyeska agrees by contract to be the response action contractor for people who file contingency plans, all the shippers that come in there. So they have agreed to comply with the contingency plan. And their agreement is part of the spill plan. I mean, they have to have somebody who'll do it.
Well, I just misunderstood a comment of Michelle's.
On that point, okay, Alyeska has agreed to be the spill responder to all the ships that come in, and all the ships that come in must have a contingency plan. Is that
That's
what you
correct.
Said?
Well, I'm not positive. I assume it's all. I know it's for all the major shipping. Yeah, I assume so.
So,
They maintain the equipment. They have all the facilities ready to respond, you know, all the skimmers and one thing or another, and they agree to do it if somebody spills.
So, along comes the tanker Washington?
Overseas Washington.
Overseas Washington. And they say, well, God, we'd like to respond for you, but you have a problem.
Now, you're not big enough. We need a bond.
We need a bond.
Yeah, because if you spill oil and we get sued for it, and we go clean it up, and we get sued, you don't have possibly enough money or enough responsibility to respond to us for the damages that we get sued for that we want to come back against you and collect. If it were Exxon or BP or somebody, we wouldn't worry about it. But because you're only Tesoro or you're only Conoco, you know, the damages might be far in excess. The damages we get sued for might be far in excess of the value of your company, right? So we want a bond, you know, which will guarantee and exonerate us against any lawsuit we get sued for, right? And failing that, which you can't supply, we want our liability lessened. That's this bill in a nutshell.
And never mind the fact that there are differentials in size, differential in safety features, and Representative Finkelstein.
I'm still working on trying to understand your preference in the world, the RCAC's preference in the world. Okay, I guess I misstated. You wouldn't be happy with everyone under gross negligence, except if you're subject to a plan. It's simple negligence in following that plan.
No, it's this. It's not a question of why you get away from the plan. It's simply that if you promise to do a plan, you have to substantially conform to the plan. That's the term, substantially comply. If you don't substantially comply, then you don't get the immunity from simple negligence.
Okay, everyone would be subject to gross negligence except that case. People who are subject to the plans and who fail to follow the plans
substantially.
That'd be the exception. That'd be your position. Just so I can understand it, what's some of the other shippers' positions? So I can understand that on that exact point.
Well, this is Gene Burden. We posed this proposal in the language that our RCAC
had in an initial draft, and have been advised that that still maintains a simple negligence standard and would not be acceptable to satisfy the problem that we have with Alyeska. We are still looking at that language, however, and think that may well be the basis for working out something that would help resolve this.
And Mr. Chairman, just let me finish it. I mean, I try to look at it from your point of view. It seems like, you know, you want some guarantee that your sincere efforts to follow a plan won't be misjudged as, you know, not being the case. Maybe, you know, we can find some wording, you know, that gets to that whole point of when they are substantially in conformance to it. Because it doesn't sound, I mean, of all the things we've been talking about, this difference doesn't sound to be the hugest of differences, to tell you the truth. If, you know, there's some room there to tie the concept of the plan in, if you're willing to tie the plan in, then obviously I see it'd be different. So.
Deborah Roth?
I thought I just might raise a couple other policy issues that I see as implicit in this whole activity, I guess. One of them is that what the bill, this version and the other versions that have been circulating, do is shift the responsibility for paying damages from the response action contractor to the spiller. And that may or may not raise an issue from the injured party's perspective. If a response action contractor does a negligent act that causes damage, this law will shift the responsibility for paying those damages to the spiller. And the question that I think that needs to be addressed is, can the spillers pay for that kind of? And I think that the legislature addressed that issue last year when it passed financial responsibility requirements for shippers and so on. But I just raise it as something that's you're broadening the potential liability of a spiller is strictly liable for the damage caused by the spill anyway, right now. But suppose that the response action contractor rams a $400 million fishing boat in the process of trying to clean up the spill, and that's a negligent act. And so we have, say, $500,000 of fishing boat damage that the fisherman wants to be compensated for. This bill says that person turns to the spiller of the oil for collecting those damages. It's just an issue that I think the legislature ought to kind of be aware of and consider. Another one is a timing consideration. The purposes, findings and purposes in this draft, and which I think I have some problems with, as does Michelle, talk about the emergency nature of the response. And I think it's worth thinking about whether the legislature wants to lift the level of liability to which a person will be held responsible from gross negligence, from ordinary negligence to gross negligence, forever. We're still cleaning up the spill that happened over 2 years ago, and I guess I just think it's a public policy concern whether people who are no longer under any stretch of the imagination in an emergency response situation shouldn't be held to a standard of ordinary care. I think some of the drafts have time limits which would go to addressing the question of whether something's truly an emergency or not.
And Ruthie.
If I could follow up on what Deborah has said, that is another real concern of our council, and we have suggested as an initial shot at setting that time limit of 30 days or less. It's a sufficient amount of time to transfer a situation from an emergency situation and the chaos of the first few days or first couple of weeks to a situation that's under control. But we're really not interested in seeing this kind of limit of liability go on for an indefinite period of time.
Representative Carney?
It seems like 30 days is a long time. Why not 15 days?
Sounds good to me.
Well, it just seems like 30 days is a long time to call it an emergency.
In any case, it satisfies Alyeska's concern because they're normally out of this within a matter of a few days.
Ricky,
wait a second. Everybody is saying this is an emergency and this is a crisis situation, and I'd like to think for a minute that what happened during the Exxon Valdez spill, it was made an emergency situation because the equipment wasn't there. They weren't following their C plan. I mean, a lot of that emergency, I think, was actually created by the response action contractors themselves. And I think, hopefully, I hope that in the future, oil spills, if they happen, will not be so chaotic because there'll be a trained team of people to jump in. And we don't need 30 days, we don't need 15 days, we don't need zero. It starts, liability starts immediately.
Gene Burden?
I'd like to respond to just a comment that Deborah made, and it deals with the financial responsibility consideration. Alyeska has demanded $1 billion in direct action financial responsibility. The fact that we're trying to seek a resolution of this via the legislature and by agreement with Alyeska in no way should be interpreted as our acknowledgement or recognition of that being a reasonable or in any way a depiction of the exposure that exists in this situation. We're talking about damages arising out of the simple negligence of the response action contractor, period, and that's it. Secondly, the current financial responsibility obligations for tankers in Alaska is $20 million, and that's in effect until the implementation of 567, which is what, June 1st. At that time, it goes on the basis of the capacity times $300 a barrel. Overseas Washington has a requirement of $202 million worth of insurance. We carry a total between the tanker owner and Tesoro, $1.05 billion worth of insurance, not including that of Crystal, and that also available under Tobalop. So, even when the requirement was $20 million, as it currently is, there were not very many shippers that did not carry at least $700 million in financial responsibility. The problem is that this is not directly actionable type insurance. I think that we have presented, John has to I believe this committee last week, a description of what are the available means of additional financial responsibility beyond that of the either the plant holder or that of the owner operator of the vessel. They include state as well as federal sources of funding. When you put this in perspective, even though it's been called a $1 billion requirement, it's our opinion that that's vastly in excess of what the exposure rate is. And I think it's a disservice to try to get this accomplished to think of it as we've got a $1 billion exposure sitting here just because Alyeska said it is.
Gene, you talked about direct actionable. Would you expand on that, please, for be uninitiated?
I'll try. The insurance available at these levels is, for example, $700 million of the insurance that we've accumulated with the tanker owner is protection and indemnity insurance. And that's placed with a company called GARD, G-A-R-D, it's a Norwegian company. And GARD goes out in the reinsurance market, and there may be as many as 400 to 1,000 different companies that have pieces of that insurance package. And the organizations, P&I clubs is what they're referred to, we came up last year, I think.
The P&I clubs are
protection and indemnity,
okay,
clubs. They simply, as a matter of policy, there aren't any of those organizations that will agree to have registered agents in any of the states, not just Alaska, but any state, due to the complexity of of having a direct action in Alaska court. All a direct action means is being able to file suit directly against the party that's providing the insurance or surety. They simply will not put a registered agent in the state, and they will not, I guess you can say, yield to the state's authority as far as litigation is concerned. What that means is that instead of some of the smaller insurance policies that you can get and have direct provisions for intended beneficiaries where that party can go directly against the insurance company, that doesn't happen under these circumstances. If there's an accident that gets to that level, then we have to go with that $700 million P&I club. The damaged party would have to sue us to invoke the coverage of the insurance. That's the problem. Alyeska wants to be able to go directly against the source of the financial responsibility instead of having to sue us.
So in other words, they would like to go directly to the P&I club.
That's correct.
To get their hands on the $750 million.
Right.
And why has it become a, I guess I don't understand why that is a direct action when, in fact, well, what happens if they if they're forced then to come after you first? How does that become an indirect action?
Well, I don't know whether you want to get into this, but we might as well tell me if you want to make this briefer. But if you know, the concern I think that is there is that if there was a major spill, there aren't very many companies operating in Alaska that could survive a spill like the Exxon Valdez. And certainly we're the smallest of the people that operate in Prince William Sound. There's only five others now. And so there's an obvious concern that if we had a massive spill, that Tesoro would go belly up and you've got someone in bankruptcy. And that could conceivably complicate the access to the P&I club coverage. There is a British case that was House of Lords in June or July dealing with a British P&I club where this sort of issue came up, and the British courts held that instead of paying the proceeds directly to the damaged party, they would go into the equivalent of bankruptcy court for distribution. That's not the law in the United States, nor is it the law in Norway. There's a Norwegian Supreme Court case contrary to that, that in that set of circumstances, the proceeds would go directly to the damaged party rather than going to the bankruptcy court. But that did have some play, my understanding, in some of the concerns that Alyeska has expressed.
Thank you. Thank you, Gene. I know we're getting a little far afield maybe, but perhaps not. These all have bearing on what we're trying to unscramble here and construct. So, are there other comments or questions John Tilling has?
Just briefly, a comment on the timing limitation and then kind of a general thing about where we are, because I think the timing limitation exhausts the second significant area of concern, at least between folks over there and folks over here. On the timing, some folks over here and some folks over there. With respect to a timing limitation, one thing that the chair had asked me to do before the end of the last hearing was to obtain and copy all of the other state laws of states that have either enacted the gross negligence standard or were on the verge of it, meaning it had passed both houses. And we did that. Let me just pass these out, and it's along with a summary chart. And you can see from the summary chart that HB 196 is pretty much garden variety in terms of what the other states have done. And if you take a look at the second column, you'll see how many of these states have been interested in a timing limitation, and the answer is one. The state of California, which limits this liability to 60 days with the possibility of a 30-day extension from their Department of Environmental Conservation, whatever they call the Department of Ecology or whatever it is in California. And that was the result of a political compromise between the California Trial Lawyers Association, which was the big money group fighting this bill in California, and the cleanup co-ops and so forth. There is something to be said that at some point in time the emergency calms down and that justification goes away. The question is, when is that? When does that emergency calm down? Well, the judgment of the California legislature is in a coastline in which every mile of it is connected by road. The emergency goes away in 60 to 90 days. What about in the Chukchi Sea? The second issue is that if you end the limitation, if you end the limitation at a date certain, are not you running the fear of your contractors walking off the job? Because on day 31 or day 61, they've lost their immunity. Maybe you are, maybe you're not. We don't know because we've never put contractors in that situation before. And shouldn't you at least then provide an avenue of escape for the on-scene coordinator to say at day 60, as California does, that, hey, alternative resources ain't there. If Harry walks off the job, I'm stuck. Or conversely, the emergency is still going on. These guys still need immunity. And give the on-scene coordinator the flexibility to extend the period. Because the on-scene coordinator is the one who's going to know what the situation is. And then the third thing you have to be sensitive about is that the list I just gave you is getting longer. Texas, the one state I gave you was that was green when I showed the map to you because it had passed both houses, is now blue because Governor Richards has signed the bill. So the entire Texas coastline is now under an immunity regime. And does Alaska really want to stand itself out as saying we're going to be particularly hard on cleanup contractors? We don't care if we put ourselves at a competitive disadvantage, go do business in California, you don't have to do business here. Now, having said all that, that's sort of the case against a time limitation, or if you're going to have a time limitation, don't make it any shorter than California's and give the on-scene coordinator some flexibility. But having said that, just as RACAC has made their case for 30 days or for 15 days or whatever, I think that those are pretty much the two areas, the timing issue and the substantial deviation from the contingency plan that the parties have been talking about. And I don't think it may be as far apart as our prospective roostering here might suggest. And I know there's other parties. There's other parties to our right, just as there are parties to RACAC's left, but that will always be the case. There are some other things like tightening the definition of response action so that it applies only to the actual cleanup and not to what happens 2 years ahead of time. I thought that was something that we kind of agreed needed to be done early on, and it just slipped through the cracks, and that's a good idea. And then people may want to fiddle with the findings, and there may be some things of that magnitude. But in terms of the fundamental things between kind of the parties in the middle on this issue, middle left, middle right, I think that's pretty much where we are, which is kind of a frank and blunt way of putting it, but I'm trying to move this along and telling you kind of where the parties seem to still be apart.
I'd like to go to Larry Smith and Homer. Are you there, Larry?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to follow a lot of the conversation, and hopefully I won't be redundant. I did hear some of what Mr. Tillinghast said, and I guess the radical party that's missing from this conversation is Alyeska. Where is Alyeska? Usually we have Mike Williams in a production worthy of Walt Disney Studios playing on that of the spectrum. They claim they're the number one response action contractor in the United States. I can't believe they're indifferent to the fate of this legislation, and I can't believe they don't have information that's important to the legislature in considering the bill. I would suggest that they be asked to come forward. They would strike me as being the principal beneficiary of the legislation. Around here, you don't find the bird people or the autumn people or the log boom people or the nearshore responders from the fishing fleet expressing a desire for relief from this kind of liability. This is initiated other places. I think the time has come for us here to focus on the immediate problem, and that may mean a different kind of legislation, but Alyeska's personal responsibility requirements seem to be the problem. don't see that the time has come for further limiting already limited response action contractor liability. Ideally, Alyeska, which has been very clever about making happen the things that decide are in its interest, will decide its interests lie in finding a way to help Tesoro remain competitive, especially in light of Tesoro probably having to step up and help out with the market that Chevron is preparing to withdraw from in South Central Alaska. Alyeska should just find a way to adjust its bonding requirements for a company like Tesoro that's taken the lead in oil spill prevention by using hydrostatic loading of double bottom tankers and enhanced complements of crew and other measures. I am part of the 567 regulation working group, and I'll tell you that Alyeska comes there and argues for universal prevention credits for every manner, even the mildest activity that might prevent an oil spill. I think that they should therefore recognize in their own business that Tesoro could use some of that credit right now. If they want the state to provide it for Alyeska, it should be sauce for them in the Tesoro situation. And if Alyeska can't find a way, the legislature could provide regulation of crude shipping insurance practices to assure that competition is not stifled in the oil industry in Alaska. The state might also think about taking responsibility for providing some guarantees to make it possible for progressive companies to remain competitive, guarantees in the way of meeting the bonding requirements. But still, it looks like to me that the natural solution lies in Alyeska. The least they could do would be to extend the temporary agreement for financial responsibility requirements that they presently have with Tesoro for another year, at which time I think the picture is going to be a lot clearer. Many things going on. The Coast Guard is promulgating regulations having to do with restrictions and during adverse weather conditions and possibly more tug escorts or capable tugs standing by in Cook Inlet. And the 567 regulations will at some point be promulgated, and then it's going to be a lot clearer to everybody what folks actually have to do. Because of the unfortunate delays in 567 regs, there's a great deal of confusion about compliance right now. It'd be more obvious in 1992 or 1993 what kind of things, if any, ought to be adjusted by the legislature. I do suggest that the Soros problem is important and that it ought to be resolved, and that industry ought to do that voluntarily, that Alyeska has posed this problem for us, and I'd like to hear it pose some other kinds of solution besides what we're looking at in 196. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. I agree. I think that this is not a piece of sausage we should try to solve in a time crunch, but solve it we must, and we'll keep working at it here. Ricky, you had a comment.
Well, I just wanted to clarify that I'm sitting here actually representing two parties tonight, United Fishermen of Alaska and the Oil Reform Alliance. And I guess that I'd just like to continue to be a member of this committee and not have it look like all the compromises need to be done between RACAC and the oil industry. I mean, I do think that the radical rights and the radical lefts need to be worked in here, too.
Well, of course, this is a subcommittee of the House Resources Committee. This is a working group, and that's why we're here, to ensure that everybody gets fair contribution, and I appreciate the reminder. Other comments or questions? Ann Rothley.
I'm not sure if it's appropriate at this time to raise it, but I do want to respond to something that John said regarding the fact that because California is more accessible and the oil activity is more accessible, that 30 days here in Alaska seems unreasonable as opposed to 60 in California. And we wrestled with that, and basically we came down to this.